Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There is a shortage of teachers right now in California and across the country. A recent Frontline Education survey of nearly 1,200 school districts found a record 2 in 3 reported a teacher shortage. Ahead on Insight, we'll explore the nation's worsening teacher shortage and what can be done about it. And what happens when you consult 3 professionals on the same thing and get 3 different opinions? Well, that's an example of what Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman and his colleagues call noise. Kahneman and Paris-based professor Olivier Sabony join us today with more on noise and human judgment and why it affects everything from criminal justice to medical treatments. But first, the nation's political landscape continues to evolve, including plans by Democrats to expand voting as Republicans push for limits in GOP-led states. Vice President Kamala Harris faced some criticism over the weekend after suggesting during an interview with Soledad O'Brien for BET News that it would be difficult for people living in rural communities to make photocopies of their IDs. Here's a clip of what she had to say, and it starts with O'Brien's question. Let's take a listen.
Is agreeing to voter ID one of those compromises that you'd support?
I don't think that we should underestimate what that could mean. Because in some people's mind, that means, well, you're going to have to Xerox or photocopy your ID to send it in to prove you are who you are. Well, there are a whole lot of people, especially people who live in rural communities, who don't. There's no Kinko's. There's no Office Max near them. People have to understand that when we're talking about voter ID laws, be clear about who you have in mind and what would be required of them to prove who they are. Of course, people have to prove who they are, but not in a way that makes it almost impossible for them to prove who they are.
We're talking politics to start today's show. Ken Rudin is the host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast and joins us now. Welcome back to Insight, Ken.
Good morning, Vicky. Thank you.
Well, what did you make of the criticism Vice President Harris received over the weekend? Were the comments about rural communities in America tone deaf?
Well, it's clear that voter ID is one of the sticking points between Democrats and Republicans over what new voter changes in the voting laws should look like. I think Democrats are coming to the realization that they're not going to get any agreement with Republicans without the thought of voter ID. I thought Kamala Harris's explanation was a little bit convoluted. I mean, about, you know, talking about Kinko's in rural country, rural parts of the country is one thing, but it's part of a whole bunch of pretty much negative things that we're hearing about Kamala Harris, about the way her office works, about the thought processes being involved, the fact that people are within her office are complaining about the top management, and you know you always think of how exciting it was when she was picked for first woman of color to be on a ticket, first person of color to be on a ticket, a presidential ticket. And then you hear all the infighting and the confusion going on. It's a bit of a come down, especially when the Democrats need unity more than ever, considering the fact that the Republicans are especially unified.
Yeah. And when going on the voting issue and the voting rights issue, I mean, the bigger picture with that is there's this tug and pull that's happening. This comes as Democrats are investing more money in expanding voting rights, but the Supreme Court ruled to uphold voting restrictions in Arizona, which likely helps Republicans pushing for limits in GOP-led states, right?
Well, I think it's even more than that. I don't think of it as a push and pull. I think the Democrats only almost seem stymied by what's going on, because as we're seeing right now in Texas, there are voter restrictions that will probably be passed in the Texas Senate tomorrow, the House later this week. There are 22 measures since January 1st. There have been 22 measures around the country in 14 states that restrict or inhibit people's right to vote. Democrats would like to have these great bills passed by Congress, but that went nowhere. And as you point out, that what the Supreme Court said about what's going on in Arizona, that didn't help the Democrats either. So There were some Democrats who were saying, why can't we play rough the way the Republicans do? Because the Republicans have no fear, no shame, no inhibitions of passing these bills that either restrict the amount of absentee votes, whether you have drop boxes, whether the hours could be extended, things like that. And that hurts Democrats, that hurts people of color, that hurts people in rural communities. And the Democrats seem to say, we're just standing here and taking it, and we may only have Congress for another year before the 2022 midterms, when many people expect the Republicans to take over. It's time for us to do something dramatic and bold, and right now we're not doing it. Mm-hmm.
I mean, going back to Vice President Harris, I mean, you touched upon there really is a razor focus on her every move and every decision that she's making. In that same interview on BET News, she said that she had to work on saying no to President Biden more often. You know, Vice President Harris is in charge of a number of high profile, complicated issues, including the southern border, expanding voting rights, which we just talked about, closing the digital divide. How do you think she's fared in her first 6 months?
Well, a lot of it we don't know. I mean, obviously, the press has not been good. I mean, the Republicans have been attacking her, but they attack women of color. They've been doing that from day one, so that's not a surprise. But we're also hearing it from Democrats, too, that they're not seeing a coordinated effort from the vice president's office with the presidential office. Now, as far as whether she has to say no a lot, I mean, that's what a good thought-provoking vice president does. Aside from the January 6th insurrection, I don't think Mike Pence said no to Donald Trump once in 4 years. So whatever she's saying no to, just like when it was Obama and Biden, a lot of their conversations, a lot of their disagreements were behind closed doors, was between just the two of them. And I think that what Kamala Harris does, look, there's no question that she is smart. She understands politics really well. She serves as district attorney, attorney general in the U.S. Senate, now vice president. She knows what she's doing, but she also has to have a staff that supports her all the way. And that's the concern of some Democrats, that she doesn't have a united front within her own office.
The responsibilities that she is tasked with, is that normal for a vice president in terms of the workload? Is the deck stacked against her?
Probably since Walter Mondale in 1977. Before that, you know, basically vice presidents were sent out to go to funerals. But Joe Biden has given her, yes, she's given her a tough assignment, and perhaps it's even a no-win assignment, especially on the immigration and the migrants piling up at the border. But I think, look, very few people think that Joe Biden is going to stand for re-election in 2024. And you have to think that Kamala Harris would be the leading Democrat in that race. So I don't think he's giving her too much to do. I think what he's doing is exactly right, given the fact that she needs to have a record to present to voters should she be the nominee in 2024, or if not sooner. So, I mean, is it an easy task? No, but politics ain't beanbag. And I think if you're going to present something to the voters, you have to have a successful record. And that's what she's hoping to accomplish.
And you brought up, you know, the allegations of a toxic work environment that Politico reported a few weeks ago when it came to Vice President Harris's office, staffers saying that they were constantly thrown under the bus. Now, for Harris's part, she threw a party for her staffers a few days ago. But I guess overall, what do you make of the scrutiny the vice president is facing? Because the work environment anecdotes and these allegations, they date back to before her vice presidency.
Look, I mean, you know something, first of all, a lot of it could be, I mean, a lot of it I know is led by the conservative media. And of course, they'll say everything they can about Kamala Harris, you know, as they did about Barack Obama, who, of course, you know, was born in Kenya for all they were concerned about. So I don't think the reality is part of what they're trying to do. They're trying to discredit. And then look, and the fact is that so much of the conservative media is praising a Donald Trump and praising, I mean, look at Fox News, the way they're responding to vaccines, and they're applauding the fact that people are not getting the vaccine, which is insane. The fact that more people are getting hospitalized, more people are getting sick because of this new variant of the COVID virus. And in voters in conservative states, political leaders in conservative states are cheering the fact that people are not getting the vaccine. That's insane. So if you want to talk about what, you know, the kind of criticism politicians are getting, we should be focusing on the really nutty stuff. The fact is, look, it goes with the job. I think Kamala Harris knew what she was getting into when she took the job. Is the criticism more tough and more brutal than other vice presidents? Maybe, but again, you know, if she is the ultimate next running presidential nominee, she has to just be able to be a big boy and take it, or a big girl and take it.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with the political junkie Ken Rudin about the latest in U.S. politics. If you have a question or comment for Ken, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. There was a pretty big symbolic development that happened this morning. The top American general in Afghanistan stepped down, signaling another step closer to ending its 20-year war. President Biden also announced that the U.S. military mission in Afghanistan will end August 31st, so that's earlier than what was originally planned. This all comes as Taliban insurgents continue to gain territory across the country. What are the political consequences in the weeks and months ahead?
That's a great question. I mean, obviously, when, you know, we think back to 1975 when the U.S. said, OK, enough is enough. And the U.S. troops famously left Saigon on that ladder from the top of the building going to a helicopter. And the U.S. left Vietnam to be communist run and united communist run. There's no question from the beginning that any discussion about a U.S. pullout from Afghanistan would mean that the Taliban would take over. It would return to its rule. It would turn to its restrictive and barbaric way of governing. But look, if after all these years, after all the billions of dollars that the U.S. spent on trying to train Afghani troops, the billions of dollars that went to corrupt leaders in Afghanistan, nothing changed. The people's minds, you know, the hearts and minds of the people of Afghanistan never changed, that the Taliban still has as much control as it did years ago and it's gaining every day. Then what can we say? I mean, you're going to, you know, sure, there are some people like Lindsey Graham who says, well, it's a mistake what we're doing. We shouldn't leave Afghanistan to the Taliban. But what have we accomplished? All the lives, all the American lives that were lost in Afghanistan since 9/11, what did we gain out of it? Did we stop the Taliban? Did we end the corruption? No. So sure, there'll be a criticism of Biden that we're leaving the country to the Taliban. But I mean, even Donald Trump said enough is enough. This is an unwinnable war. It's time to get out. The generals weren't crazy about it when Trump said it. I don't think the generals are crazy about it when Biden has said it. But I don't know what the alternative is. Have a war forever, stay there forever, and nothing changes? I mean, it's terrible what's going to happen to the people there, but I think this was a ticking time bomb that was going to happen no matter when we left. And we can't stay forever. And it's not worth a single American life if nothing is going to change. Mm-hmm.
Well, pivoting to another dramatic change over the weekend, President Biden fired Social Security Commissioner Andrew Saul, a Trump appointee, after he refused to submit his resignation. Saul then told The Washington Post he will actually challenge the legality of the firing. Ultimately, how will this impact Americans who depend on Social Security benefits?
Well, that's it's funny the way you asked the question, because Republicans are saying now with Andrew Saul gone, Americans are going to have more difficulty getting their checks from the pandemic fund. I mean, that's just crazy. The fact is, Andrew Saul was a Trump appointee who is certainly the president certainly has the right to replace him and fire him. And the fact is that there are a lot of things that he did that was actually hurting the effort to get the checks out. I mean, because he basically did not agree with the Biden method. So Saul had his problems. He was asked to resign. His deputy was asked to resign, and he did resign. Saul himself wouldn't do it. The president rightly fired him. And now the president is looking for a permanent director of the Social Security Administration.
Last question, bringing it back home to California, the recall election for Governor Newsom is coming up. How does that factor into the bigger equation for the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, remember when Gray Davis was a part of the recall effort in 2003, and of course he was recalled from office, and the Democrat on the ballot, Bustamante, the lieutenant governor, failed to beat Arnold Schwarzenegger, and that was a big victory for the Republicans. It's not the same as it was back in 2003, but the fact is that Gavin Newsom has done things that are probably not so smart politically. He is not the most likable guy in the world. And even though the budget looks great, I think the response to the vaccinations has been great. He's made some mistakes along the way. If he should be recalled, it's interesting. The Democrats are saying, don't put another Democrat up on the ballot. It'll show that we're fearful of defeat. Now, of course, if he's recalled, the Democrats are screwed. But right now, I think the fact that they're having it early, the fact that they're having it September 14th, the fact that they're having it earlier before the Republicans could get completely organized and raise money, I think he survives it. I don't know what it does for his White House ambitions, what he thinks, you know, whatever White House ambitions are left. But the Republicans basically could have waited until 2022 and ran against him then, but they're not doing that. And so far, I don't see anything that seems to imperil his governorship and his reelection bid in 2022.
Ken Rudin is the host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Thanks for joining us again today. Ken, always a pleasure.
Vicky, thank you so much.
Up next, the pandemic has exacerbated what was already an alarming teacher shortage across the country. We're going to look at what's driving the shortage and how it might be turned around. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The demand for K-12 teachers outpaced supply in the country's public schools by more than 100,000 in 2019. That's according to the Learning Policy Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based education policy think tank. Now, after more than a year of teaching through the pandemic, that demand has just been exacerbated. Many teachers burned out, rethinking whether to stay in the profession. New Jersey High School principal Karen Bingert recently told CBS News that a teacher shortage in her school has been brewing for years.
There are fewer candidates going into education to begin with. I think some of that stems from the fact that over time, just there's been less interest. There's been a little bit of public pushback on the respect with which teachers are treated.
Now, for his part, President Biden has said he wants to fix the teacher shortage and included $9 billion in his American Families plan to focus on training, equipment, and diversity. Carolyn Jones is a senior reporter with EdSource, which is a nonprofit organization reporting on education challenges in California and beyond. Carolyn has been covering the teacher shortage and more challenges facing academia as pandemic restrictions loosen up. She joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Good morning.
Carolyn, the big question first, what's behind the teacher shortage we're seeing right now?
Well, I think it's, you know, what we just heard. I mean, teachers are burned out. It's been a brutal year, I think, for everybody, but especially for teachers. When the whole pandemic started, you know, teachers were hailed as heroes because suddenly parents had a taste of what it was like to try to homeschool their kids. And so there was kind of this honeymoon period where everyone loved teachers. And then as things wore on and there was a lot of, you know, union pushback against reopening plans and so forth, suddenly everyone decided they did not like teachers. And I think it's just been really stressful, you know, this kind of back and forth, and teachers are just trying to, you know, keep it together and educate kids as best they can. So a lot of them have been very burned out.
What are some of the struggles that teachers have faced over the past year, more than a year, that will likely follow teachers into the fall semester?
Well, I think there's still a lot of issues about safety that have been unresolved and are still kind of lingering out there, particularly with the Delta variant and reopening plans. I mean, I think most schools plan to reopen fully in person this fall, but there's a lot of dispute over mask wearing and social distancing and testing and safety protocols. And I think that a lot of teachers, particularly those who live with vulnerable family members, are nervous about it. So a lot of that's still being hashed out. And you know, as we all know, that's all highly controversial.
Anecdotally, whether, you know, you're a family or you know teachers, I think this recent survey by the RAND Corporation just kind of quantifies and quantifies maybe anecdotes that we've heard personally. The teachers are nearly twice as likely to experience job-related stress, three times as likely to experience depression when compared to the general public. You know, what's taking a toll on teachers' mental health?
Well, I think the teachers, like everybody, have been affected by the pandemic. I mean, not only were they working under kind of extremely stressful circumstances last year, trying to navigate distance learning, and for some of them, the technology was really difficult. But then they themselves had to, some of them had to homeschool their own kids simultaneously while teaching classes. Or, you know, money, you know, pay is always a problem for teachers. A lot of them really struggled financially, or they might have had family members who are out of work. And it's, you know, it's a difficult, stressful job. And especially now, you know, I think so many students are experiencing mental health issues that teachers have been kind of put in this role of, you know, to try to be a counselor too, on top of trying to teach the curriculum and get kids caught up academically. And that's just a lot. It's a lot for teachers.
You know, the shortage predates COVID-19. What was going on before the pandemic?
Well, the teacher shortage in California anyway is primarily math and science teachers. And that there, the reason is because people who have expertise in math and science tend to go into the tech sector, which pays really well. And it's just very hard for public schools to keep up with, you know, to match those salaries. And then in rural areas, too, it's very hard to retain, you know, to recruit, attract, retain teachers because, you know, young people tend not to want to live in rural areas. They want to live in cities. And then special education is always a particular, I mean, that's been going on for years just because it's such a difficult job. And you need special training to do it. And people get very burned out. So that's been, and then also bilingual teachers, it's very hard to find bilingual teachers. And in some districts, there's more of a need for that than others. I mean, some rural areas have such a hard time finding, you know, like, for example, someone to teach AP chemistry that they just, they're not offering chemistry. It's, you know, it's really dire. So if you're a student in those areas, you just can't take chemistry. So it's got really, you know, it's, there's a lot of repercussions. Or in other schools, there's, you know, some, I think there's one district that had, I think 50% of their teachers were working on emergency permits, which means they weren't fully credentialed.
Wow. When looking at solutions, the Biden administration is planning to address the problem in the American Families Plan. Are you optimistic about that?
Oh, sure. I'm always optimistic. and I think, you know, the state, too, is really, you know, investing a lot in programs to help teachers pay for teaching credential programs, recruiting teachers, teachers of color, especially. A lot of districts are offering signing bonuses. The state has kind of streamlined the system to become a teacher. There's hiring fairs. There's help with, a lot of districts are offering help with housing, especially in kind of high cost areas. they're working a lot on the teacher pipeline, you know, trying to kind of streamline the way that people become teachers starting as young as high school. You know, a lot of high schools have engineering academies. Some of them now have teacher academies where you go directly from the high school to the local CSU to the local school district. Those have been really successful. There's a lot of programs to kind of lure kind of mid-career workers in the tech field to teaching. Like if for some reason you don't find working at Google to be satisfying or rewarding, then you can go, they're making it easier for those people to become math and science teachers. And I've talked to a number of those people and they love it. That's been very successful. They don't love the pay cut, but they love everything else about it. And you know, there's a lot of big investment in these teacher residency programs, and programs also to, you know, encourage new teachers to work at high need schools in exchange for, grant money to help pay for their student loans and so forth. Those have also been very popular. So there's a lot out there. People are really trying hard, I know, to help to improve this.
What about the substitute teacher and the supply there? Is that an issue and also a challenge?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of substitutes have been hired. I mean, this past year, there was such a need for substitutes that a lot of them have just been hired as teachers. And so that shortens the pool right there. And then I know a lot, you know, during distance learning, it was a little bit easier because technically you could hire a substitute who lives anywhere. They don't need to live locally. So a lot of districts were hiring, you know, people who live across the state to substitute. So, but now that schools are reopening in person, it's going to be a huge problem, especially special ed, math and science. In fact, sometimes, you know, the principal, like if they can't find somebody, the principal just has to go in and teach the class for the day.
Wow. And I think this just really goes along the fact that, you know, over the past decade, enrollment in teacher prep programs has fallen. And I believe it's fallen more than a third, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. So what's keeping would-be teachers from pursuing an education degree? And I just think it's so interesting that people are pivoting from Google to go to teach in schools. And I think that shows how fulfilling it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pay is always an issue, especially in, you know, the Bay Area or Los Angeles, you know, places where it's, you know, really, really expensive to live. It's very hard to live on a starting teacher salary unless you live in a house filled with roommates. And then also, you know, kind of the teacher respect issue. I mean, if you tell your family and friends you want to be a teacher and they all say, "What? Are you crazy?" That doesn't help. And so I think that there's a lot of effort to sort of raise the prestige of teachers. So that's, and also, you know, retirement, a lot of teachers are just kind of throwing in the towel. I think this past year, there was a 26% uptick in teachers retiring, according to the teacher retirement system. So that's been a big problem, too.
When talking about teacher turnover and teacher attrition, I mean, there are high achieving jurisdictions such as like Finland, Singapore, Ontario, Canada. Are there lessons we can learn from those areas that we can apply to help lower the turnover and encourage teachers to stay in the job?
I think that, you know, in those countries, teachers are paid a lot more money relatively. And those, you know, I think in Finland, and I hear this from my neighbor who's from Finland, is that, you know, when you tell people you want to become a teacher, it's as if you're telling them you want to become a doctor or a lawyer. It's highly valued. It's highly respected. And that is someplace where we can all start here, I think, is just treating teachers with a lot more respect and giving them a lot more support than we do here.
Looking ahead, the fall semester, what are some of the challenges schools are facing as they reopen campuses and also doing to better prepare students for in-person learning and hopefully gain back learning loss?
Well, I think mental health is the key issue there. So many students over the past year said that they felt kind of rather serious levels of anxiety and depression and isolation during distance learning, that it's not going to like be like we flip a switch and everyone's ready to sit down and start learning again. It's going to take a while for kids to adjust to be back in the classroom, back with their friends, back in school. So a lot of schools are just, you know, right now and then into the fall, focusing on nothing except mental health with students, social emotional things, you know, small group discussions, you know, how are you feeling today? You know, trying to get kids to talk about their emotions. And then also just a lot of time playing, getting outside, playing games, getting to know each other. A lot of these students don't even know each other. So getting to know their teachers, you know, and the state budget had a lot of money for mental health, and they're kind of an unprecedented amount of money. And a lot of it is one-time money. So some schools are using the one-time money to hire more counselors, which is great. But then they're also doing things for one-time investments, such as building campus wellness centers. Those have been really popular. Just kind of a classroom on campus where kids can go at any time to talk to a counselor, to meditate, to read a book, to, you know, to just relax, basically. Those have been really popular. Schools are setting up partnerships with community organizations that address student, you know, young people's mental health. They are establishing partnerships with county offices of public health to kind of streamline the mental, you know, the behavioral health system for children. And as a way to build Medi-Cal for those services, which has been really successful in some counties. And also training staff, including teachers, on how to do sort of basic mental health screening with students. And then, you know, if they do seem to need more serious help, then referring them to counselors. So, yeah, schools are really doing a lot to prepare for this fall.
Are there specific measures being taken for higher need student groups, such as children in special education?
Yes. Well, that's, you know, some kids in special ed did well during distance learning, especially some kids with learning disabilities, because they were able to sort of start and stop. And so schools are trying to be a little bit more flexible with that, allowing students to, you know, continue learning from home if they did better that way, or do some kind of hybrid model. So schools are really trying to accommodate what worked well. I mean, there were some real surprise bonuses for some students during remote learning. Some kids really, you know, the technology was great for some students. And so schools are trying to accommodate that. And then also, I think as we go into fall, there's a lot of extra funding for special ed right now. And so schools are really trying to do more inclusion, including special ed kids in the regular classroom with extra support. You know, there's more money now to get you know, aides and assistants, reading specialists and so forth. So that's a hope going forward that will stay. So, yeah, there's some exciting things happening.
Yeah. And obviously there's a lot more to follow. And with your expertise, being a senior reporter for EdSource, what are you looking at going forward?
Well, a few things. One is that I'm really curious to see, you know, there's a lot of money being sent to schools right now, and I'm really curious to follow up on that money to see how it's being spent and, you know, some of the accountability. We don't know if these things are going to work or not. I'm going to check in a couple months and, you know, we'll see, you know, all this money being spent on mental health. Is it actually doing anything? I mean, is this really what kids want? So I'm curious to follow that. And I'm also curious to see if some of this one-time money gets spent on staffing and things that aren't really, you know, those are going to be ongoing expenses. I mean, it would be a shame if schools hired a bunch of counselors and then 2 years from now have to fire them all. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to follow up on that. And also, you know, the learning loss, I think, is something we're all going to be monitoring really closely. There's been a lot of talk about learning loss, but it's sort of we don't know how bad it is or how quickly kids are going to catch up. And some kids are going to catch up, you know, really quickly, and some are going to take a long time. So that's something to watch closely, too.
Carolyn Jones is a senior reporter for EdSource. Thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Sure thing.
Still ahead, unpacking what our next guests call noise in professional judgment and why it affects everything from criminal justice to medical treatments. You can join the conversation, too. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. In expertise we trust. Throughout business, science, medicine, and the law, we count on the experience and training of professionals to deliver consistent information and judgments. But what if medical diagnoses and the same symptoms differ hugely, or judges are swayed as much by the time of day or other happenstance? Well, in their new book, Noise, A Flaw in Human Judgment, Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman and professor of strategy and business policy at HEC Paris, Olivier Ciboney, explain how noise undermines the workings of professionals in sectors like medicine and law. Wherever there is judgment, they argue, there's noise, and we are largely unaware of its power. Fortunately, the problem isn't only highlighted, there are also some powerful remedies. Daniel Kahneman and Olivier Ciboney join us now. Welcome to Insight.
Glad to be here.
Glad to be here, too.
Well, how do we define what noise is?
Well, noise is unwanted variability in judgments that should be the same. So if you have different judges looking at the same case, you would expect them to pass the same sentence. So not the same, because judgments never is completely consistent, but reasonably similar. In fact, it turns out, there is huge variability when different judges look at the same case. They pass sentences that can range from 30 days to 15 years for the same crime. So that's noise. And it turns out that there is noise everywhere we look.
Well, that is obviously one big impact, an example that you just provided. Olivier, how does noise affect us in other ways of our lives?
There are lots of examples. And as Danny just said, wherever you look, there is noise. And wherever you look, there is more than you think. So take something where it doesn't affect us daily in our lives, obviously, but take fingerprints. We expect that when fingerprint examiners look at fingerprints and determine whether a fingerprint that lifted from the crime scene meets the fingerprints of a suspect, we would expect this to be very precise, to not be a matter of judgment, in fact, to be a matter of fact, where you would expect perfect consistency. And in fact, it's not perfect. It's, of course, not as variable as the examples Danny was giving, but it's far from perfect. So we expect it's perfect, it's far from perfect. In something like medical diagnosis, where we expect quite a bit of consistency, of course, we're vaguely aware that when it's a really tough diagnosis, we're going to ask for a second opinion. But in general, we would expect that by and large, doctors would know what they're doing. And yes, of course, by and large, they do. But sometimes there is actually a big difference between what physicians looking at the same case will say. And sometimes even the same physician will be sensitive to the time of the day or to fatigue or to other factors that change their diagnosis from one moment to the next. So in justice, in medicine, in forensic science, and of course, in everything that has to do with HR, we also find the same finding.
So what do we do when we get different answers on the same subject from different professionals? How do we remedy that? Daniel, you can go ahead and take it.
Okay.
Your
I'll
turn.
Take it. We speak of a set of procedures that we call decision hygiene, which are procedures that people can adopt, that organizations really can adopt. They're more obviously suited to organizations than to individuals, that will generally improve judgment. And there is a list of those. They're not terribly complicated, but it turns out that they're not generally used. And so I'll give you an example so that it won't stay completely abstract. When we look at problems like hiring someone, there is a way of reducing noise in evaluations or in interviews. And this is that instead of trying to form a general impression of the individual, you structure the impression. That is, you take different dimensions and you evaluate them one at a time. And you form a global impression only after you have evaluated the separate dimensions. In other words, you delay intuition. So the general rules of breaking up problems and delaying intuition This is one of the steps of what we call decision hygiene.
You also make an important difference between bias and noise, because, you know, when it comes to cognitive biases, letting your own personal experiences shape reality, you've written about how both influence decision making, but they do so in different ways. So how does noise differ from bias?
It's actually quite simple. And the best way to think about it is to think of an example where you are making a judgment on a quantity. So suppose that you're making you're, for instance, setting a price. You're underwriters in an insurance company and you're setting the price, you're setting the premium for insurance policies. If, on average, all your underwriters setting the price of policies set them too high or set them too low, that's an average error, and we'll say they have a bias. They have a bias towards overpricing or underpricing. The same would be true if you're making a forecast and your forecast is on average over-optimistic or overly pessimistic, which is less frequent. A bias is an average error. It's a shared error. It's a mistake that we, that the majority of us tend to make. Noise is the variability. It's the dispersion around that average. So if you take the underwriters or the forecasters again, yes, they have an average error, but they're also not in agreement with one another. And the variability of those answers is also a source of error. It's noise. Bias and noise are distinct. They add up. They both create error. If we want to reduce error, we need to tackle bias, of course, but we also need to tackle noise.
Daniel, you wrote in the book that bias has a kind of explanatory charisma, which noise lacks. Can you unpack that quote a little bit?
Well, in general, when we think of people making errors, it's a standard way of explaining it is that they're biased in one way or another. And bias, we interpret as a force. It explains, when we use the term bias, it explains why somebody is being discriminated against or why a judge is overly severe. That we understand what bias is. Noise is very much more abstract. That is, when you'll never point to a particular mistake and say, oh, that mistake is noise, because what defines noise is not one particular judgment. It's a difference between judgments of the same thing. And so it's easy to imagine bias because you can see bias in a single case. It's very difficult to visualize noise because noise is sort of a statistical concept. And yet, noise and bias are actually independent sources of error. And in principle, they're equally important sources of error, which is very difficult and non-intuitive to most people. Mm-hmm.
Olivier, when talking about cutting through the noise, I mean, that takes a great deal of self-awareness. When it comes to a company and an organization, how can they begin this process? Because within the book, you describe a noise audit. So what exactly is that?
Well, it takes a lot of self-awareness, but in fact, it takes an organization, as you point out. Only an organization is going to be able to solve the problem of noise, because noise is a problem for organizations. As individuals, we may be noisy from one moment to the next, but the big problem is that your judgment and my judgment, if we are both asked to look at the same case, are going to be different. It's not because you're wrong and I'm right, or you're right and I'm wrong, at least not every time. It's because we're different. The job of the organization is to make sure that these differences, which of course are wonderful and to be celebrated, do not become a cause of error when the organization is making decisions or when we're making decisions on behalf of the organization. And the first thing to do to make sure that happens is to measure how much variability there is today. That's what a noise audit does. It's essentially an experiment in which you take a number of problems, you give those problems to different individuals, and you measure how much they disagree. When the insurance company we talked about did that, they found that the average difference between two underwriters looking at the same case was a lot more than what they thought. They thought it would be in the range of 10%. They found it was 55%. When the judicial system did the study that Danny was alluding to earlier, when he was saying sentences ranged between 15 days and 30 years, or 30 days and 15 years, they had no idea that the differences would be this large. Getting a grip on how large the differences are is what a noise audit will do. It will tell you how big the problem is. Then you can start practicing decision hygiene to tackle it.
Right. And decision hygiene is basically a set of procedures to reduce noise in the form of prevention, correct?
Yes. In principle, you know, decision hygiene will reduce bias as well as noise. Those are generally ways of reducing error. And I should add that although it's very difficult to say that an individual making a specific judgment, say, about hiring someone or about marrying someone, it's difficult to say that that decision is noisy. You can apply, and probably individuals should try to apply, decision hygiene to their own decisions. So decision hygiene is easy to imagine and implement in organizations, but the principles apply to all decisions and all judgments. There is a way of improving judgments, and it's a matter of making judgments more disciplined.
How can we apply it on an individual level? Because there are several components that we can apply just in our daily lives.
Well, one example that Denny mentioned earlier is breaking down a big decision into smaller inputs and smaller components. That applies when you're hiring someone, but it also applies to any big decision you have to make. Suppose you're choosing an apartment. It would make sense to define in advance what are the dimensions on which you want to evaluate that apartment, what are the scores that you're going to apply to those dimensions to make sure that you gather the information about those dimensions. In some of the apartments you look at, it might be obvious. In others, it will not be obvious. So this will make sure that you cover the dimensions of the problem. Now, some people would tell you, and then take the average of those scores. We're not saying that. We're actually saying at the end of that process, once you have informed your judgment and your intuition with all the pieces of evidence that you can gather, and once you have structured your judgment along a number of dimensions that you have decided matter to you, use your intuition and your judgment to come to a conclusion. That's an example of how you can structure a decision. There are other decision hygiene techniques that we haven't talked about. One which individuals and organizations alike can use is to aggregate the opinions of a number of different people. We know for a fact that if you take the independent, and I stress independent, opinions of multiple people, the average of those opinions will be closer to the truth because it will be less noisy than the opinion of one randomly chosen individual. You can do that in an organization if you do it the right way, if you don't have a meeting where people talk and reinforce each other's prejudices or biases, but instead you take the average of their views. You can also choose to do it as an individual. Get inputs from other people and take the average of those inputs. That's a pretty good practice even for personal decisions.
Yeah, I'm curious, when looking at the examples that you provided within insurance or within courtrooms, did you see any pushback from implementing those guidelines to constrain that noise that we're talking about today? Because change can be kind of difficult for people. And if you did see pushback, how would a company or an individual overcome that?
Well, I think it's too early to judge how much pushback there is. The book is just out. We don't know how people will react to it. It's quite likely that many people will just avoid the problem. And we're quite prepared for that because dealing with noise is embarrassing and unpleasant. There is something really almost humiliating for an organization to discover that its employees just disagree with each other on judgments where you would expect them to be consistent. So there's going to be quite a bit of reluctance, but we think that some people will want to implement noise audits. Noise audits will tell them that they have more noise than they expected, and then some of them will decide to do something about it.
You know, finally, just going back to the very beginning when you started this journey about noise, what was it about noise that piqued your interest and held your attention, which came to the fruition of a book?
Well, I'll take that one. I have personally been a student of bias most of my professional life. So cognitive biases has been one of the main topics of my career. And seeing that there is another source of noise, which is really another source of error, which is really generally neglected. There's very little treatment of it. Everybody knows about it. Everybody knows that there isn't perfect agreement. But in general, although mathematically the two sources of error are really equally important. One of them completely dominates the discussion of error. And it was that realization that there is more noise than people expect and that it's generally neglected that made us feel that maybe a book was needed and a book would help. So that's what we tried to do.
Daniel Kahneman is a Nobel Prize winning psychologist and Olivier Saboni, a professor of strategy and business policy at HEC Paris. They are the co-authors of the new book, Noise, A Flaw in Human Judgment. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Cap Radio's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.